suppose you've done some really... I should say, I gather that the way... I don't know if people are familiar with Dragon Dictate, but for a while it was pretty much the dominant firm in that space. And then they unfortunately got bought out by a much larger firm, which shortly thereafter turned out to have been cooking its books and went broke. So I think the software got passed on to someone else, but Dragon Dictate doesn't. Dragon Systems doesn't really exist. But I gather that Dragon Systems started out with a man who was an academic, or maybe both him and his wife, I'm not sure. The wife ended up running the firm, but I'm not sure if the original scientific work was both of them, but who were doing academic work on speech recognition and came up with, I gather, a substantially better way of doing it. So suppose you're in that, you've just done that, but instead of doing a commercial product, you decide to do it as open source, maybe as part of some larger open source package someone is doing, and now you suspect someone has done it. So in that case, how might you provide evidence they've done that? Take the specific speech to text example, because that's one where I think you can imagine clues and ways in which you could produce evidence that was what was happening. Yeah? Well, it's doing speech to text, so it's not how it pronounces. The other way around. Suppose you say, well, I did a really good job, but it just couldn't handle a German accent. And so you have a tape recording of someone speaking with a German accent, and you put it into your program, and it turns out it gives you text all right, but it's wrong in a particular way. You feed the same tape recording into the what you suspect is pirated. I'll be darned, it makes exactly the same mistakes. So that's, it seems to me that it's going to be different for each case, but that if you think of any kind of software where the output isn't perfectly determined by what you're doing, where you're doing something hard enough so it does it imperfectly, you ought then to be able to test what the particular imperfections are, and that, it seems to me, might give you the evidence you want.
That's going to put an example. When you say present sequence of words and it writes out certain things.
That's the next step. That was the next step. Do people know how encyclopedias solve this problem? What? Information, exactly. That I'm told a standard trick for maps and encyclopedias, which is an area where you've got copyright coverage against derivative works, but people can publish things that really are derivative works and pretend they aren't. And that the standard thing is that your encyclopedia has an article on some non-existent small town in Central Asia somewhere. And when that non-existent small town in Central Asia shows up in the new encyclopedia brought out by a different publisher, you have pretty good evidence they're copying from you. And I gather, I would think it was a little bit risky with maps, but maybe if you actually put a road in that isn't there, you might get some complaints. But you could imagine putting a small town in that isn't there, and that's not likely to do much harm, you know?
I had one question, one comment is because I'm taking IT survey that actually was like the textbook or casebook case as a copy of the phone book. They put in false information.
Right.
My second question was binary. That binary format,
yeah.
Is that comparable? Could you reduce the source code to binary format and then compare the binary?
You could, but it probably wouldn't work, because the problem is the binary that's calling it binary is basically object code. It's machine language. I mean, everything is binary in the sense of the form the computer reads it. But the problem is that that two different compilers for the same language compiling the same source code won't give you identical object code. Right, the compiler is telling the computer to do something, but to take an obvious example, what register in the CPU you store a particular number in may be arbitrary. You could put it in the A or the B. You know, imagine you're doing something where you're adding two numbers. You put one of them in A register, one of them in B register, and then the central processing unit has a operation which sums the content of the A and B register and puts it in the C register. There's no significance to which of the two numbers goes in A and which in B, but that's going to be different machine code according to which way it does. So my understanding, without having actually looked at the guts of any compilers, is that there's a noticeable amount of arbitrariness in how the compiler works, and that therefore my guess is that you couldn't do it by comparing the object code. You could do a little better if you were willing to decompile, if you're willing to turn the object code back into assembly language, which is the... you wouldn't get all the way to assembly, I don't, to source, but you could get assembly sort of an intermediate step, which is a human level set of instructions of the form, take the number from here and put it there. And so maybe if you were the programmer who had written the thing and therefore knew exactly what the sequence was, aha, here is a sequence of operations, which was the clever thing that I put in, and so forth. So you could, I could imagine doing that. But I would guess that either the idea of putting in a deliberate trap. Now, the one problem with a deliberate trap is that's going to be harder to do in open source because you're distributing the source code. So the people who want to pirate your stuff, if they're really willing to go to enough trouble, but they probably aren't, could go through your source code and say, what's every one of these things doing? Aha! What that's doing is saying, if you say the following 17 words, print out, this is pirated code. Right. So you'd have to be moderately subtle. You'd have to put in something which did something unexpected without making it. And you might argue you're now violating the open source rules because the source code is not supposed to be deceptive. The source code is supposed to actually tell people what the source is doing so that it's useful. But nonetheless, I suspect there are ways you could do that sort of thing. But it did seem to me sort of an interesting question. Yep.
So I was thinking, there is a way to decompile it. I mean, there's only so many compilers out there. You can try and decompile it. But if you, let's say if I suspect Dragon Tech, they're copying, I buy their software, download it, and decompile it. Am I not in violation of
your license?
Yeah,
you may well be violating your, depending on the form of the license they have. That's a very interesting question, and I don't know. You might be able to claim that if it doesn't work, you never tell anybody you did it. And if it does work, you then claim they've got unclean hands because they were using their license to conceal illegal activity. But you people are more closer to being lawyers than I am. So, yeah?
I think where this question actually come up is, if someone, they would work on open source software, also do this for a living, like they have these skills.
Sure.
So someone who doesn't make open source realizes it's a good idea and uses the same skills that they use in the open source version, which I think some projects are working on are fun.
Yep.
And those two projects have similar code, and the same person wrote them.
Yes, but then he could demonstrate that because, after all, he's an employee. He's got a name. His name is on the list of contributors to the open source thing, and there's nothing, I don't think, that would prevent him doing that. That is to recycle the idea as opposed to the actual code. But it occurred to me that one other way you might do it is, suppose you're part of this open source project and the commercial program that you're a little suspicious of comes out, and 3 months later somebody in the open source project reports a bug. And maybe you're the one who fixes the bug. You say, wait a minute, if they copied it, that bug will be in the commercial product too. So that would be another way in which you might be able to demonstrate it, by showing that bugs that were discovered after the thing was stolen were in that. But I agree, it's an interesting question, because it's a different world from what we're used to with copyright, and yet it raises its own...
It's even harder than enterprise software, right? I mean, you're thinking about consumer software, you can download, if I include it as part of the standard only enterprise, it's not available generally to the open source community and all that.
Yeah. But of course, if you're using it as enterprise software, there isn't much incentive to close it. Right? In a sense, if the only thing I'm using the program for is inside my firm, I might as well keep it open source.
Well, I'm sending it to enterprises. They're
from
me.
I see. I see. Right. So you're selling it to multiple enterprises.
Yeah, but it's not available generally to the public to check all this.
My guess is that that's going to be true for ordinary copyright violation as well, that if I'm selling to a very restricted market, the odds are pretty good that I'll never be caught, even if I'm actually engaged in once in a while in the academic world, someone is caught doing plagiarism, which is sort of, it's not the same thing as copyright infringement, but it's a similar problem. But I think it tends to be in fairly high-profile cases. You know, when, I forget who it was, but somebody reported various stuff about gun ownership in, I think, the revolutionary or just post-revolutionary America.
And people eventually demonstrated that he was lying, that the data didn't show what he said. But that's an issue which people care about a whole lot, and therefore it makes sense that people would do it. And if you just imagine that you're selling a product to 10 firms, you know, what are the odds that somebody is ever gonna spot it? All right, the next question was from A.K., who is Alexandra.
My question was, who has standing to enforce an open
right.
source license and intellectual property developed under it? So it's kind of a two-part question. The first part is enforcing the open source license. The second part is not enforcing intellectual property, since obviously the whole idea of this open, but preventing other people from asserting any intellectual property against it.
Against? Sorry, do you mean against it or in it?
Against. So, for example, any patents that might result from the creation of the open source software, we want to have some kind of mechanism to prevent other people from asserting their intellectual property against it. So one way to do it would be to develop patents and contribute that to the public.
That is, one of the open source rules is that if your software uses any patented material, you are supposed to have gotten a release from the patent holder giving a royalty-free license for that use.
So the question with that would be, if they didn't do that, and it's difficult to trace back which individuals worked on those particular parts, who's responsible for it?
Yeah, my impression is that part of the system is designed to let you trace that back, because there is a list of contributors, which I think says who contributed what lines of code. But beyond that, I guess I'm still not sure I understand. Let me take the first question first, because that one I think we can answer.
Yeah.
Who can enforce? The first point is that if you violate the terms of the open source license, you are, in a sense, committing two different offenses. One of them is you're violating a license. But the other is that you're also violating copyright law, because permission to make the copy was conditional upon abiding by terms of the license. So at least in principle, you can be sued under copyright law as well as under contract law. And then the question is, who can sue you? They have answers. That's an answerable question. I know the answer because I looked at the legal research that was done in the past for this course, which, as you may have noticed, was conveniently linked to the bottom of the issues page if you wanted to read it. And the normal answer almost certainly is any contributor. However, the Free Software Foundation, to simplify the matter, has as one of their rules that you use their license, you are supposed to assign the copyright to them, and then they're the ones who can sue. So in the case of Free Software Foundation stuff, the answer is the FSF can sue, and in the more general case, I think that any contributor can say, look, you're violating my copyright because this chunk of code was my creation and therefore I have copyright on it, and you haven't followed the license, which was what the permission to use copyright stuff was conditioned on, therefore you violate copyright. So I think that's an answerable question. Now, whether any such suits have occurred, I don't know. I think they hadn't at the point when my students last did research on it, which would be either 2 years or 4 years ago. But I haven't followed the field, so I don't know. But then now I'll explain your second question, which I'm not sure I followed.
So the second question is, intellectual property other than copyrights, let's say patents,
yes,
that are developed through the creation of open source software.
So developed through the creation, you mean that when I, as a contributor, figured out how to do the speech-to-text recognition for this program, which used that along with other things, I thought up a brilliant new algorithm for doing it, a brilliant new procedure for that, which was in principle patentable. Did I patent it?
So that's the question. The scenario that I was thinking in my mind is some company asserts their patent against this open source software.
Yes.
Saying that it's their intellectual property, their patent intellectual property.
And so they have a patent which they've applied for and gotten and all the standard stuff.
Yes. So a common tactic to counter that would be to either assert your own intellectual property against them or to show that your intellectual property is different. And
that is showing it's different is just showing you didn't infringe.
Yeah, and then one way to do
but
that...
But I'm not sure what you mean by assert your... The only way to assert your intellectual property against them is to argue their patent is invalid because...
But another tactic that you have in litigation is you can assert your own patents against them.
Yes.
To kind of create a stalemate.
Yes, right.
Bounce it out.
But that requires that you have those patents.
Yes.
And since the normal open source procedure, you probably never applied for a patent, so you don't have one. But if you did apply, if I understand the open source rules, if while I'm working on my part of the open source project, I come up with this brilliant idea and say, aha, I want to patent that. I believe I can patent it as long as I include, when I pass on the open source project, a royalty-free license to use my patented idea in the use of this program, which I can still collect royalties people who use it anywhere else, right? So you could do that. I don't know if it ever, it's ever happened, but I don't see any reason why you couldn't do that in open source. But if you haven't patented it, it's going to do no good. Now, a different issue, which I've seen discussed in a different context, is the worry that people will patent things that are really already known. And you see the assertion that software people who are skeptical of the patent system, which many of them seem to be, argue that what happens is you have some technique which everyone in the field already knows, but the judge doesn't know it, and therefore when one company or one person tries to get a patent in it, they succeed in getting it, and then other people have to pay for what they were doing before. And there was, in fact, a project. I don't know if it ever happened. I tried to get Santa Clara involved in it at one point in nanotechnology, where some of the nanotech people said, look, the same thing's going to happen with nanotech. So what we want to do is to create an archive, a publicly viewable archive, where anybody who comes up with any idea in nanotech that he thinks might eventually be patentable puts it in the archive so that we can prove when someone tries to patent it or does patent it that there's prior art and therefore it's unpatentable. And you, I don't know if that's ever been done for software, but it's one approach by which people with a sort of the open source view of the world, people who want to limit the application of intellectual property law, might try to do so.
We are back with you.
So, something with all the clear benefits in the United States, now you've got open source floating all over the world. How do you expect to take around the world? The source was coded out itself. That's a problem with source code. They want to tell them how you go and prosecute somebody.
How do you prosecute someone who tries to include, who uses it and closes it?
Yeah.
So what's the then I can understand you probably will never notice it, but assuming you know someone is doing it, what's the problem?
So I've been jurisdiction issues there.
How do we enforce copyright in general? That is, after all, almost, I don't know if there are any countries at the moment that aren't party to the copyright accords, but certainly almost all countries are. For a fair while, Taiwan wasn't. And you could buy cheap pirated books there. But Taiwan, I think, is now a party. And, of course, 100 years ago, the U.S. wasn't. It was the pirate nation of the world then. But I think pretty much everybody is now. So what problems does this raise other than ordinary copyright?
It's a practical problem. You want to do the judicial system to enforce some kind of open source license. I'm not sure how practical it is.
That is presumably... Practicality, I can't speak to, but in terms of sort of the theory of it, you say, look, they're violating our copyright. The only excuse for doing it is this open source license, which they're not abiding by. Therefore, we're going to sue them under copyright law.
Well, I think in commercial realm, there's plenty of financial incentive to do this, but I think open source, why would anybody?
Whether anybody.
As a system, it's not really enforceable in that sense. I mean, I don't know if it works.
The question is how enforceable it is.
Yeah.
In the U.S. context,
I guess you raised the question later of whether it's worth the trouble.
In the U.S. context, what's the payoff if I win that case? What do I get, assuming you're a firm that actually has money to pay damages?
What are the damages?
What determines the damages in copyright law? Anybody want to tell us?
The profits, right?
That depends. That all depends. What determines the damages in copyright law?
Is it like patents, like a reasonable amount of reasonable royalty?
Got no copyright attorneys in the room? The answer is that if you have registered the copyright, there are then statutory damages. And statutory damages for unintentional infringement are, I think, a few thousand dollars, and I think for intentional infringement they can go up to $100,000. I don't know enough of the details to know what determines the exact amount, but it's, my understanding of the situation is if you haven't registered the copyright, you can collect actual damages. But that if you have registered the copyright, you can collect the larger of statutory or actual damages. So that could potentially be substantial amounts of money for deliberate infringement of a registered one. And I do not know how often open source projects register, but my guess is they sometimes do. It seems an obvious thing to do under the circumstances. So that once you've registered your copyright, now you can get substantial amounts of money. This is an issue, not just in this case, but you can think about all of the attempts by the Recording Artists Association to enforce their copyright against people online. One of the reasons why it isn't an absurd idea is that if you can prove that 1,000 people have pirated your song, you know, $2,000 each comes to $2 million. So in that sense, it then does become real money and potential serious issue. All right. Next one is also yours, so why don't you read that one or discuss it or something.
So as I understood, the open source licenses, usually the AU, there are two kinds of licenses. I think at least the MIT license and the OpenGL license. The MIT license is pretty understood.
More than two, but anyway, there are quite a lot of different ones.
Major ones are that. Those are the OpenGL, I think, in that if you include any part of the open source into your code, you have to disclose the entire source code.
Correct.
You're part of that.
Correct.
Code, right? So if, for example, I did that and I did not disclose and somebody sued me, would the remedy be that I have to just disclose the whole thing, or would it be just...
That would be a possible remedy, but what's the other obvious remedy? You violated their copyright. So you owe damages for copyright infringement, and you are required, you get an injunction to stop selling your code. Right, because that code is an infringement of copyright. Yeah, I don't know if you have any specific performance isn't all that common in the legal system, so I don't know whether you could ever get that, and maybe you could, if you could argue that somehow the damage had been done, you have lots of copies of your commercial program that had been sold before they caught you, that therefore just stopping doing it wouldn't be sufficient. You could imagine. But again, I'm not a lawyer. You ask a judge.
I mean, in this case, specific performance stuff, so are they not asking a person to do some labor or something?
Yes, just reveal something he's got. Yes. No, in that case, it's more like the case where you do get specific performance, which is sales of land, which is sort of, I think, almost the only case where it's common in contract law, as I understand it. So... Notice, however, that it's perfectly legal for me to distribute your open source code with its source code and along with it my closed source code, which, say, interacts with your open source code. So it presumably really is a matter of how much you incorporate it. You would think that the sensible thing to do, if I had a good reason to keep my stuff closed, possibly because I wanted to sell it or because it had secrets, is that I say, all right, I'll take your open source code, I will modify it in such a way that another program can interact with it. So your code processes information in form X, and that's what I really want. My program code does a bunch of stuff, including the processing, so mine sends a message to yours, it processes it, it comes back. As far as I can tell, I'm in the clear under the rules. If I now give away the package, or if I give away the open source and sell mine,
As far as I can tell, I don't see why I'd be infringing any of the open source rules as long as they're separate things. I think that's right. Now, it may get complicated because how separate is, again, I'm not a professional programmer, and clearly there are cases where you've got a program that's calling stuff from a library, and I'm not sure if the library has been literally incorporated, which would, you might want to do because you only want the parts you're using, or whether the library is sitting on the hard drive next to the program.
In the license, they have some language to protect, so they try to... what incorporate means,
yep.
How you're talking to the program. But it is part of the library that you supply to your customer, that it is part of that library, that I think they call it incorporate.
Yep. The, so then your next one we discussed a little bit, which is what damages you can claim, and then as I think the answer is first that you could claim statutory damages if you've gotten a if you registered the copyright. But the other thing is that if you've got the power to enjoin them from distributing the software and the software matters to them, you've got some leverage to say, all right, reveal your source code for your part of the program or we won't let you keep distributing this. So that would be a potential leverage. Now, I don't know whether the Free Software Foundation actually collects and uses damages, because that would be another possibility. You could say, look, we pay us damages for this, and we will then use that money to hire lawyers to prosecute other such cases, or to, in one way or another, subsidize the movement. That my impression is that Free Software Foundation is a good deal more centralized than open source is. The Free Software Foundation is really Richard Stallman and his friends and fans, and whereas open software really is not Linus Torvalds, it's not Eric Raymond, it's a bunch of different people doing different things, talking to each other in a sense, as rather than a single organization.
One question I have about the third party beneficiary.
Yeah.
When you become part of this open source community, the whole idea is that somebody writes it, make it part of the license, so the whole community benefits.
Yes.
If somebody stole on that and not revealed to the whole community their source code, the third party beneficiary has the right.
It's an interesting question. So what you're arguing is that I have contributed chunks of the open source project.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I did so was that I would then be able to use it. And he has now incorporated my work. Well, that I can sue him for under copyright law. But maybe he didn't incorporate mine.
Yes, right.
He incorporated other people, other material from the thing.
Right.
But now I'm not getting my benefit because... Yeah, I don't know.
Because you're not revealing your source code that you incorporated, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I can even say, look, even though you didn't use my source code, the project wouldn't have gotten this far.
Right.
Maybe the stuff I put in has been completely replaced,
yeah.
Right? I wrote the chunk that did floating point calculations very quickly, but then some cleverer person wrote some even better floating point code and replaced mine entirely, so you're using nothing of mine, but I say... It would never have gotten this far if it hadn't been able to do floating point calculations last month before they made the improvements. Therefore, I really could be. It strikes me like, as though it's sort of, it's going to be a little hard unless the judge likes you, but I'm not sure it's impossible. It's an interesting argument. All right, next we are back with Alexander, I think. Alex, I guess is how you sign your name anyway.
So my question was kind of answered during our discussion about scanning. But basically, it's who's responsible if an open source program created with input and contribution to many people violates a third party's intellectual property rights. And it appears that the answer would be if it can be traced whose portions are the ones that actually violate.
Yeah, well, that may be fairly hard, and in principle, of course, even if someone else did the pirating, I'm not supposed to pass it on. So yeah, what my impression is that an intellectual property law doing things deliberately raises the penalty, but that you're still illegal even if it's not deliberate, right? Isn't that correct? So therefore, if you used his patent without permission, and then passed it on, and then added that to the program, and I then took a later modified version and made use of it, in principle, I'm violating his patent, right? And I don't know whether there would be damages or only an injunction. Yeah?
I was going to say, in this case, I don't know how copyright infringement works yet, because I only studied patents, but it seems like, especially in the case of Linux, if there's somebody on the other end receiving suggestions to the open source code and then approving them, that sort of approval, as the law currently stands, might just be contributory infringement, so they're not actually doing it, they're just receiving it, but I think that putting a stamp of approval on it should also be
Even if there's nothing that makes it obvious that this was violating a patent. If you think about the fact that in the present state of patent law, it, I gather, takes a fairly extensive search to find out whether what you're doing is arguably covered by a patent, because part of the problem with patent law compared to traditional copyright law is that ideas don't have sharp boundaries.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's not like I copied 17 lines for him. It's rather I did something which I thought up all for myself, but as a matter of fact, he thought up what was really the same idea, 3 years earlier and patented it.
That's
so, yeah?
There's a recent case law regarding the concept of infringement, which if the person thought to be like a checkmark or approving the source code, he did the sentence called willful blindness. Like, he went out of his way because whatever disturbance happened, even though it's highly suspected one, he should have done a little bit of diligence. If it's not that he was willfully blind,
This was a patent violation?
Yeah, it was a patent. Yeah. So,
not a copyright.
Yeah, not a patent. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
This recent case law, in that case, I think the people who were in the patent, they just went out of the way to not, throw their head in the sand. And that actually.
But was the implication that if they hadn't done that, if what they had done was to make a quick check, as it were, to see whether there was anything obvious, but it wasn't obvious, that they then would not have been liable, or what would have happened?
I can get into the details of the case, but there are three standards. That it's not just...
Yeah. But you would think that even in that case, they have to stop doing it once they've been notified, right? And that would also could be a serious cost if doing it was, part of what your business was. What it was about. Now, in theory, one of the open source rules is that the software is not supposed to include anything patented unless you have a royalty-free license to go with the software. So I suppose you could argue that if you are either the owner of the project or someone downstream, you could say, well, look, it's only because he defrauded me by putting in this patented stuff and not telling us. So I guess conceivably I could sue the person who put it in if I got sued for violating the patent, maybe. I don't know what I could try to get indemnified. I don't know again, I'm not a lawyer, but my impression is that if you deliberately mislead me in a way which results in my injuring someone else, that may give me a potential tort action against you. And that would be the case. But, of course, the real case is likely to be one where he didn't know it was patented either. Right? He invented it himself. How did he know that someone else invented it 3 years earlier? And, it's not like this is his business. It's not like he has a team of lawyers checking out everything for patent. I mean, the anti-patent people argument on software, basically, comes down to the idea that it raises the cost of programming. Because having invented something or having copied something from textbooks or people you now have to make sure that nothing you're doing is violating a patent, which is expensive and is therefore hard for individual programmers to do. I think that's the argument that's made. And it's an interesting case if you look at the history, because it used to be the case that software was considered unpatentable. And there was a long tug of war between the Supreme Court and the CAFC, the Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit, where the CAFC thought that software ought to be patentable on the grounds that it was an invention just like anything else. There was a old line of cases which essentially held that it wasn't, that it was like a I think there was some rule that mathematical algorithms were not supposed to be patentable. And I think at this point, in theory, algorithms still aren't patentable, but in practice they are. You just have to put them in the right form.
It still wasn't patentable unless it's reduced to, object codes or...
Now that wouldn't affect. I don't think that would affect it at all. But my understanding is that in principle you can't patent an algorithm, but you can patent the use of that algorithm in your software to do something. But again, I'm not an expert on that. But I think it is the case that it moved a long way from unpatentable to in effect patentable over a series of cases. So my guess is, though I may be wrong, that one of the reasons why the spreadsheet wasn't patented was that back when VisiCalc, which was the first commercial spreadsheet, came out, probably if the people who wrote it asked a lawyer, they would be told, sorry, you can't patent that sort of thing. And given that it was one of the great inventions of the 20th century, in a sense it seems a bit unfair, and yet that's how it turned out. So the next one is a previous year student, so I'll stand in from him. Imagine open source software ends up damaging your computer. Who should be liable for that damage? The person who released the first version of the software? The person who made the actual change to the software that resulted in the damage? Nobody? Any opinions?
If it's free.
What?
If it's free, nobody.
If it's free, nobody. You think is a practical? Yeah.
There's no warranty of goodness in there. There's not a contract, so.
Well, you know, there is this idea of the implied warranty, but that's usually an implied warranty of merchantability. It's not really merchantability when you give it away, is it?
Yeah.
Back.
There is consideration. I mean, if you have to open your source code to the public.
Well, you don't have to open your source code. You only have to open your source code if you incorporate their code into yours. You can still have as many.
But that's consideration.
No, but that's additional. If you're keeping it for yourself, there's a consideration. If you choose to inspire it,
why you use it
for yourself, there's a
yeah. Back when, before Paul Goda left us, whenever the weather was really bad here, I would come into his office and explain that I felt that the South Bay was in violation of warranty because there is an implied warranty due to consistent behavior, as you may know, and that in the case of the South Bay was a warranty of good weather, and that since he was an agent of the responsible party, I felt it was necessary to warn him that we might have to take legal action if the weather didn't improve. And it worked. The weather always got better. But unfortunately, Father Goat is not around here anymore, and so I can no longer do anything about weather like we've been having today. They should bring him back. He was a delightful man. All right, so let's see. Where were we? So then my guess is that you might have a case, I don't know, if somebody knew about the problem and distributed it. And I'm not quite sure. Isn't there some kind of a legal action for someone who sort of knowingly spreads traps before other people's feet, so to speak, or not? What? You don't know. Yeah. All right, well, but my guess is that as a practical matter, the answer is probably there is none. Though I wonder about the Free Software Foundation, because they're sort of a better target than a whole bunch of separate people, and whether there are some circumstances. Suppose they've sued you and collected money and you're therefore mad at them. Could you make some argument if their software had damaged your system? I don't know. All right, we are back again with IA, who has generously contributed to this discussion quite a lot of stuff.
This question is similar to what you mentioned before. But this was the thing I know, at least with licenses, you can do away with the contractual damage and all that. But I think tort is a separate feature.
So, what are the sort of tort injuries that you're imagining happening?
Well, I mean, if somebody uses the software, you package it, and you somebody else, and some damage happens to their business.
Well, you'll notice that commercial software routinely disclaims consequential damages.
And I assume that they do that because I think it'll actually stand up in court, though I don't know if it's been tested or not.
Well, I think consequential damages could still come under the contracts of theory. The tort is a different theory.
But then what would be the tort theory? That is to say, I may have some bug in my open source software, and you take that software and you use it to run your business, and it tells you that the bid you should put into the federal government for their sealed bid auction, you can do the job for $1 million, but in fact it's going to take you 10 million this place to decimal place.
Maybe
it
could be a deliberate bug in it that somebody
places in the job. That would be a different, because the one I'm describing sounds like consequential damages.
Yeah, but if somebody puts a virus or bug in it and it spreads because of it.
Maybe.
Now, the person, so there are two questions. One, can you do away with tort liability? And second, who is going to be part of that? The whole chain will come in, the person wrote it, the foundation.
Wouldn't it be hard to argue that anybody in the chain prior to whatever it was being introduced had any obligation, had any liability? After all, if I shoot you, the manufacturer of the gun isn't normally held liable, even though without the gun I couldn't have shot you. So wouldn't you similarly say that if I take Linux as it now exists, bug-free, we will suppose, and do a modified version of Linux with a bug specifically designed to target you because you happen to be an Iranian nuclear scientist. This is part of the Israeli or U.S. Covert cyber war, which is really one of the weirder and more interesting things that's been happening of late. And then that bug, unfortunately, while it does do things to slow the Iranian nuclear, he also has the same software, and he's a perfectly innocent person having nothing to do with Iran, and it damages his centrifuge, which is being used for some unrelated purpose. And then the question is, who can he sue? And it seems to me he's not going to be able to sue Linus Torvalds, because Torvalds is the equivalent of the gun manufacturer. He produced the thing to which someone added the bad thing. Isn't that right? Am I wrong?
So do they accept the change of the code? I mean, you could have your own branches.
If you forked it, they surely aren't liable.
If you do something, they accept it and make it part of the official
regime. Yeah. I don't know. Isn't that going to really depend on negligence questions? On the question of, is the problem sufficiently obvious so that it was negligent not to spot it, or sufficiently obscure?
Well, that will go to jury.
I think you're right that in principle, if the person who owns the project has accepted the false thing, then you could try to sue him, and you may or may not succeed. You know, as I'm sure you know, the answer to the question is, can you sue, is yes. The interesting question is, can you collect? All right, I think we finally have something by somebody who is neither Iqbas Ahmed or Alex Korsh, who is this one by? This one is by CP, who I assume is out there somewhere. There we are. There's CP. So it's Coleman Peng. Peng is the last name?
Yeah.
Good. Coleman also sounds like a last name. That's right. Just to confuse us, right?
So this question is in response to the last part of your meeting.
Yes.
Talking about open source
crime. Yes. Open source crime control.
Yeah, crime control.
Right.
And talk about how Jason, who got responsible for selling it, organized
right.
an
right.
officer to basically catch that
person. Right.
So I know, like, for police officers, there's also those recommends, there's punishments for, not going to stuff like that. But what about individuals? This seems more like a vigilante sort of action.
So it's an interesting question, but let's put it differently. What are the respects in which a private person trying to enforce the law is more restrained, and what in which he's less restrained than a police officer? See, to me, that's really the question. It's an interesting question, and I was wondering if some of you had information about it. What are the rules on citizen arrests? Because that sort of is a standard category. There is such a thing as a citizen arrest. What are the differences between a citizen arrest and a police arrest? Yep.
Okay, I know that even with citizen arrest, whenever the police arrest limits a lot of African-American rights, because you comes on, limitation of the evidence, you make it, like, you have to use the device more well. But it's just the rest, everything is saying, we got to go away from the community.
Everything is what?
It's, you use that as evidence against them. So we collect this information as much as we can to go through whatever, and there's no...
So you're saying if I do a citizen arrest of you,
yeah,
and if you protest, it wasn't my fault,
yeah,
that, and I cleverly have my recorder running,
yeah,
that I can then use that even though I've not read you your rights.
You don't have to.
Right. Device. What's the downside?
You
I think the downside is what I think used to be true of police but no longer is, that you're liable in tort. Think about all of those cases that you occasionally read about where the policemen get the wrong address, smash down a door, throw people on the floor and point guns at them, shoot the family dog, and it then turns out that they had the address wrong.
Yeah, you don't get the luxury of mistaken identity. Like, if you can, then you get false imprisonment, batteries, false...
My understanding is that 100 years ago, the policemen would have been at risk of a tort case. And then now they aren't. That one of, I think it was one of my colleagues here was saying that if you looked at the whatever the equivalent were case books from the 19th century, that where the modern one just tells the policeman what he has to do in order that the evidence be admissible, the 19th century one tells him what he has to do in order to not be liable in tort for his mistakes, essentially. And so I think one difference is that on the one hand, law enforcement people are effectively immunized against a good, not all, but against a good deal of ordinary tort liability. But on the other hand, I think you're right that because the private person is not a state actor and that there are restraints on state actors. I mean, similarly, I presume that if the police decide to investigate a bunch of you because you're Muslims and they think that Muslims are a terrorist threat, that in principle you might have a legal action against them for religious discrimination. Am I wrong? I think that's right.
They can get away with anything that uses a national security banner.
Maybe. I'm not saying you'll necessarily succeed. My point is that in principle there are legal restrictions, but I'm pretty sure, suppose I'm a private individual, and I'm very suspicious of Muslims, and so I spend a lot of my time and effort engaged in what is on the face legal investigation. Public information, I attend the mosque. I don't think it's illegal to attend something pretending to be a member of the religion you are. Compile a dossier, discover who you've been talking to, which suspicious people, and having done all of that, I then turn the information over to the police. Again, my guess is that I'm perfectly clear. So in that sense, there are legal restrictions on state actors which aren't going to apply at the same time that there are legal privileges to being a policeman that are going to apply. So that could be quite an interesting subject. I mean, I can even imagine somebody doing a paper on that. And of course, we do have a certain amount of precedent because we are not very far from where the Committee of Vigilance cleaned up San Francisco, the city of San Francisco, somewhat over 100 years ago. All right, that's where we... I think that's where the term vigilante originally came from. It's quite interesting. When I was at University of Chicago Law School, somehow I discovered, I don't remember if I was looking for it or not, that there was one shelf in the law school library which was books about the San Francisco vigilante. And the neat thing was that some of them were on one side and some were on the other. That some of the people who wrote it, their basic story is the law enforcement was corrupt, they were letting a murderer, deliberately letting him escape so he wouldn't be punished, the sheriff was taking bribes, and a bunch of public-spirited citizens decided to do something about it. They cleaned things up, they then retired, essentially. We should all be grateful. And the other story, of course, is the one in which the vigilantes are the villains, hanging somebody without adequate, certainly without legally adequate basis, and so forth and so on. And that was quite fun. It's a 150-year-old controversy, but it still has got some guts to it. But similarly, all of the rules on shooting people, that if a burglar comes into your house and you have any reasonable claim that you were put in fear of your life, you kill him. That's self-defense, not murder. But under many other circumstances, it's murder. On the other hand, police
kill people by mistake pretty often, and a lot of the time, you know, I don't believe that if I meet you in a dark on a dark street and you reach into your pocket for something, I'm entitled to pull out my gun and blow you away because I thought you were pulling a gun. And yet police do essentially the equivalent of that, not uncommonly. So no, it's an interesting question. All right, my next one is, does the involvement of amateurs in various sorts of research affect the application of tort law to injuries resulting from errors in such research? And before I give you the example that occurred to me when I was rereading that question, let me first see whether you have comments or suggestions so as to keep me out of tort court cases.
I'm having a hard time differentiating this one from the, this one seems like a more general version of the imagine open source software damaging your computer.
Except in this case, there's a single person, I'm assuming a single person is responsible.
Okay.
And I really want to assume a case where if something was done by a firm that was in the business of doing it, they would be liable to tort. And then the question is, will that also apply if it's not being done? Let me give you my example, because it's in a certain sense a real-world example. That one of my hobbies is cooking from medieval and Renaissance cookbooks. And one of the questions that interested me and my wife a good many years ago was how you could preserve food so you could do a week or two-week long medieval camping event without bringing a cooler and having to fill it up with ice, which is a very unmedieval thing to do as well as a pain. And we came across a probably 13th or 14th century recipe for pickled meat, in which you cook meat and you then pickle it in vinegar and a mixture of other things, and it's supposed to keep. So we experimented. First we read up on the subject and figured out what you had to do to be reasonably safe from botulism. And we then pickled meat that way and put the jar on the counter and, you know, every day or two, try some. And it works. Meat's good for several weeks without refrigeration, pickled. And we then published this information. And we currently have a medieval and Renaissance cookbook. You could buy it on Amazon, self-published. It's called How to Milk an Almond, Stuff an Egg, and Armor a Turnip, 1,000 Years of Recipe. Because all of those are references to real recipe titles. Armored turnips are armored with cheese, in case you're curious. And in that cookbook, we have the description of how you do this. And we also have the comment that preserving food is dangerous. You have to be careful. As far as we can tell, either of the following two precautions will protect you against botulism, and we advise doing both of them. And we then say at the end, if something goes wrong, don't blame me. It's not put in those words, but that's what it comes to. Are we free and clear? And in particular, are we more free and clear than if we were professionals in the business writing and publishing a book on food preservation, which people, after all, sometimes do? And I'm curious, because I might get sued. Not very likely. We were reasonably careful. But what do people think? You can imagine the same thing in lots of other contexts, obviously. A book is an easy one. You could imagine other people doing something as a hobby, and everything you do, there is some probability of something going wrong, right? And so, at what point do you become liable? Yeah?
I had a torts professor that made an exam that the hypo was some pregnant woman who bought a, you know, what to expect, you're expecting type book. But there was a title in the book that, like, instead of don't eat fish because it might have a lot of mercury, it left off the not part.
Yes.
Do eat fish because it has lots of mercury and
right.
For you.
Right.
Type interpretation. And,
yeah.
So all the students, so she was just showing this stuff. Thankfully, she didn't have to take that exam. But, you know, so we were programmed to start looking for things like misrepresentation and product liability. And she said, can't bring these claims because it's freedom of speech and the words are protected. To which we had not known it was taken constitutional law, and we're totally stunned.
I hope you were correct.
Yeah, and so that's what her response was. This is freedom of speech, the words are protected, despite the fact that there's a typo in the book that eventually called this woman a miscarriage shot.
And then the question is, how far does that go? Let me take a different case. Are you familiar with a book called The Anarchist Cookbook? It was a fairly lively issue a long, long time ago. The Anarchist Cookbook is a book on things like how to make bombs. Anarchist in that sense, not in the more interesting political sense. And it was publicly suspected by various people that it was fake. That someone, probably in law enforcement, had deliberately written a book giving you bad instructions on how to make bombs in order that would-be terrorists would blow themselves up. Suppose it was true. All right. If that were true, would the authors of the book be liable in tort either to people who made a bomb and blew themselves up or to the next door neighbors of those people who got blown up as well? Any opinion? Is that covered by freedom of speech? How about, let's take a very simple case, which I'm sure is clear, and that is they've been doing some road repairs, and the result is that this road becomes a 10-foot-deep pit at one point. And the people doing the road repairs, being responsible people, have put up a couple of signs warning about this. And you exercise your freedom of speech by modifying the signs.
Yeah.
You agree that that's going to be a slam dunk case that you're liable for the person who goes into the pit as a result of that?
No, that's like wanton and willful. That wouldn't be freedom of speech.
That would be my opinion as well.
Yeah.
So does anybody know where do you draw the line?
Well, I was thinking in terms of your hypothetical here,
yep.
or like with your cookbook.
Yep.
If you got sued for that,
yes.
then what they would do is bring in an expert witness, like someone that published a cookbook. And they would talk about how they would ensure that the recipes were safe. So I think that that's just a typical court problem, and it's going to be about expert witnesses. You can bring in your own expert witness.
But it seems, the question that I was trying to raise there, which was one that struck me as interesting in the particular context of what we're discussing in this chapter, is whether I could say, well, yes, you're perfectly right that professionals doing this with a team of researchers and such would take the following precautions to make sure things are safe. But I'm not one of those professionals. My wife and I are doing this ourselves in our kitchen. We have no staff. We're not making our living at it. This is just our hobby, and we then decided to publish information for other people. We put in a warning, basically. The argument you would make is, look, everybody who uses our recipe is in exactly the same situation we're in. We're not professionals, they're not professionals. We're not experts, they're not experts. We describe the result of our researches and our experiments. If we lied about it, then you've got a case. But if we told the truth and we just didn't do enough investment in what precautions you had to take, then we're free and clear. And I don't know if that's why or not.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that the answer to that is you could do whatever you want, but when you put something out there, you undertake a legal duty, and that's a duty of care that you owe to other people that may come into the zone of
But does the legal duty depend on who? Let's take law for a moment. My guess, though I may be wrong, is that bad legal advice by a lawyer is a good deal more likely to be actionable than bad legal advice by your next door neighbor. Am I wrong? Isn't that correct?
Yeah, except your next door neighbor, they don't have a license to practice law, which is
But they can still give you legal advice in it, not for money in conversation, right?
But they couldn't represent you.
I just want to take the case where you ask somebody, if I do such and such, will it get me into legal trouble? And he says, nah, I'm perfectly safe. Nobody could ever. And he knows as much as you know. He's a blowhard. I don't think you're going to be able to get a case against him, but if he's a lawyer, I think you very likely will be able to. So then I want to claim that I've got the same exemption as a blowhard.
But you put your book on Amazon, right?
Yes.
I think that creates a legal duty.
So I don't think you have anything there. And the duty duty of care. Also, the only criteria to see if you have a duty of care is provided from this, what are you doing as far as a license? So something that, you know.
But if you're doing something that doesn't require a license, don't you still have some duty of care?
It goes, I mean, well, that's one of the criteria. So, I mean, majority of things, like right, the book, I don't think there is, you know, established duty of care.
All right. Anyway, continue, you can imagine the same thing in lots of other contexts. I mean, I would think writing a book, which maybe freedom of speech protects me, but you could also imagine the case that my hobby is building cars, right? And maybe I build cars and they aren't legal on the street because they're adapted with all sorts of rules about that. But if you think about, you know, go-kart kinds of things, clearly there are things that are really cars you can build yourself and use somewhere. And someone else driving and gets hurt, I would have guessed, although I might be liable, I would have thought that the fact that I'm an amateur would essentially imply a lower standard of what I'm expected to do than if I were a professional with money, but I don't know.
That would basically be a defense. Like, one of the big defenses supports is assumption of risk.
Yes.
So if your book said, like, this is published by an amateur, then anyone that is, like, you know, relying on your book would be assuming the risk of taking your word.
So what you're saying is you think my defense is that I've got a better claim of assumption of risk than I would be if I were a commercial.
I think that they can argue I have a legal duty, but yeah. I think an assumption of risk would be a pretty expensive.
Because it does seem to me, again, that if you're moving to a world where less productive stuff is done through organized firms or professionals and more in various decentralized, coordinated ways, which I think we are getting more of, right? Obviously you always had some of it, that these are going to become interesting questions. That to what degree are your obligations? Because you could easily enough imagine that the professionals who don't like this are going to try to argue that you ought to hold the amateurs up to a high standard in order to make it more expensive to be an amateur. May or may not succeed. We're back with CP. There you are, hiding behind something else.
So the first part of the question was related to just specifically a virtual law firm. So the attorneys are all spaced out. Sort of office. Does it impact on where the jurisdiction? I figured that out. Do association with the lawyers in Illinois. That's fine. But the second part is what about the implications of the corporation? Corporate that have a physical address in a building or somewhere, and if you're just a virtual firm.
Well, but what has to be in that physical address?
You need an official business address.
But does that mean anything more than a mail problem?
Can't be
a PO office. Suppose I say the residence of one of the 39 people who makes up this virtual firm is going to be our official address. I don't think there's any requirement there would be. After all, firms do have employees who work from home, so it's hard to see if that's going to be a serious problem. All right, I then had one that I thought was sort of interesting. A firm puts out a call to the world to solve problems. For instance, to find ways of synthesizing particular compounds, real world example, as I mentioned in the chapter, it may get answers from disloyal employees of other firms peddling their employers' trade secrets. Now, the other thing you could get, which isn't quite the same but is related, is the disloyal employee of another firm who is supposed to be working on his employer's projects, but is actually working on your projects and doesn't pay for them. So think about that case as well. How can it protect against that risk, and what are its legal liabilities if it fails to do so? So I'm DuPont, or whoever it was in that case, and I have a list of 37 syntheses I'd like to find ways of doing, and I put it up on the web, and I'm worried one of my lawyers says, look, you can get in real trouble with this, because what's going to happen? Somebody working for a competitor is going to submit a working synthesis, which, however, he didn't come up with. And you're going to start using it, and then the competitor is going to sue you on trade secret law, and that looks like a pretty clear case. And with any luck, you'll get an injunction, and you're going to have to scrap the factory you've just built using this new technique. So how do I protect myself? How does DuPont make it either prevent it happening or prevent it being liable if it happens? Any ideas?
could have whoever submitted their idea to you sign, I don't know, some sort of contractual agreement that says, you know, I test that these are not trade secrets, so that if somebody comes pointing the finger at you and says, okay, this is obviously ours, you can point back to the document and say, this is the source of the information. Maybe you connect the dots between the employees, and then you've limited your liability. Maybe it sucks because you have to, you lose out on whatever you got from them, but you don't have to go through a messy lawsuit.
Well, but the normal trade secret rule is that you owe them damages based either on the cost you imposed on the owner, on the benefit you got, or on what a fair market value would have been for the secret if you had bought it. But in most, though not all, well, not in most, in some cases you could also be enjoined from continuing to use the secret, which might be costly if you would make some costs based on the secret. And you're not protected from those things by the fact that the guy lied to you and said it was his idea. Because if you think of ordinary trade secret law, one of the normal things thought about in trade secrets is the disloyal employee who pretends something is his idea when it isn't. So I'd like some better protection than that. So no, none of you want to put suggestions for what DuPont ought to do in order to get those covered? How about DuPont says, anytime we get a solution to this problem, part of the deal is we post the name of the guy who gave us the solution. We don't post the solution itself. And furthermore, we are sending out emails to all of the major companies that do this sort of work, saying, we would appreciate it if you would check our website. And if you notice the name of one of your employees as first you solved our problem, please tell us. And if nobody tells us that within 30 days of our getting an answer, we will figure that we have made a good faith effort and therefore are free to use it.
That was my original thought, but then I thought that's totally good to deter anybody from participating in the thing, because most of these employees and things that they might be using, even if they're not taking trade secrets, they're using factory or machinery to come up with it, probably on the other employer's dime, so they know that they're going to get in trouble. So they have every incentive to keep their identity a secret.
They would like to, if they are in fact cheating in some sense. But what that then suggests to me is that if such arrangements become common, you're going to have to, just as you have, if you think about things like clean room deducing of software in order to avoid copyright violation, you have elaborate protocols to prove to people who deduced this software didn't actually look at the software and copy it. And you could imagine that if this sort of thing becomes common, the employee who wants to do this says, look, here is how I demonstrate that I did this on my own time. In my own home, I had a video camera videoing me doing the experiments, or I took notes at home. I don't know how you would do it, but it seems to me you're perfectly right that this is going to deter people who are actually cheating their employer, but then I think you're willing to do that if you can. And then you would like not to deter the people who aren't cheating their employer but might be suspected of doing so. And for that, maybe I think you would have wanted somehow to develop a protocol by which they could demonstrate after the fact that what they were doing. Maybe it might be as simple as they're saying, look, I was working in the department doing X, which had nothing to do with the synthesis, and the synthesis was in Y, so therefore I couldn't have it. I don't know how you would do it, but it does seem to me that one of the issues raised by this sort of business model is how you can simultaneously make sure that the potential victim of trade secret theft has made a good faith effort, as it were, to notify him, and work out ways so that the people who aren't stealing trade secrets can show they aren't stealing trade secrets. No? Yep.
So one other issue that I was thinking about is if you're dissuading people who are stealing or doing the proper things with their employers, what about the people that are employed by those companies but are doing this truly on their own?
What I'm saying is that in order to be able to use them, you're going to have some procedure by which they can plausibly demonstrate that, which could be as simple as they only solve problems that are distant from the work they're doing from their employer, or it could involve, say, some kind of a protocol of how you keep notes or whatever.
So the issue that I'm thinking of is, in the practical sense, if there's going to be a list of these people, and their employers are going to see it, even if they aren't doing anything illegal, there's still that kind of sense of, I work for you.
Could be, but the flip side of that could be saying, boy, what good employees we have. Look, our guy solved 9 of DuPont's problems. Could DuPont's employees solve that? Nah, they only have second graders. So you let me go on to your last question. I'm going to read it because I actually thought it was quite interesting, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Could open source software be created with a truly decentralized structure and no leadership? Could a relatively complex project like Linux be created without someone to accept the proposed solution to problems? And my answer is not only could it be done, it has been done, because, let us say, economics or physics is a rather more elaborate project than Linux. Right? And as I was saying last time, the standard academic model really is broadly defined an open source model, and it has run for a long period of time with nobody in the center. In fact, we'll go further. In my view, the attempt to put somebody at the center sabotages the project. And it's a real attempt. If you think about the role that the National Research Council, or National Academy of Science, tries to play in various scientific controversies, all right, you get a statement by the National Research Council saying, with regards to one of what was on global warming, this report explicitly endorsed the IPCC's findings as representing the view of the scientific community. So the National Research Council is trying to play the Linus Torvalds role. It's trying to say, we get to stamp this piece of research as orthodox. Now, they don't do that for very many things. It tends to be high-profile things like global warming. I think they did attempt to do something on the controversy over concealed carry of firearms. In my view, it's a bad idea. Because what's going to happen if that's an established custom is that people have an incentive to try to make sure that their friends are on the National Research Council and are the ones who get appointed to mediate scientific disputes they're a part of, and you're then moving farther and farther from a sort of a competitive open model of science to the sort of thing where there's official truth, and if you don't conform to official truth, nobody will hire you, kind of thing. So, but it just struck me. That's the reason I wanted to skip to that because we're running out of time. That really that is an example of a non-centralized one and where we're arguably the centralization of the state. Yes?
But that's kind of an example where it doesn't work for software because software needs to all work together and economists, physicists, astronomers don't necessarily work together.
Well, they work together in the sense that they're building on each other's work.
Building on and disagreeing on.
That's
software
right.
Can't
that's
disagree
right.
With software, it's going to work.
Well, they can certainly disagree in the sense that I can have a way of doing speech recognition which I think is better than yours, and you have one that you think is better than mine, and you could surely have a case where rather than having an authoritative assembler, you have people like Red Hat, and Red Hat says, well, we think that his is the best one. So we will put together his this and her that, his that, and pack that for people with a note saying Red Hat approves this. But meanwhile, Blue Hat, their worst at the thing, is out there choosing a different combination. So it doesn't. It seems to me that ultimately things do have to work together. That ultimately scientists build on each other's work, and that's a case where it seems to me that the advantages of decentralization trump this.
So we have a last question. So just like when you get it like certified, just certified as the way you enter that database. That's the
problem. Maybe. Interesting ideas. All right, we're out of time.